Part 2 of Chapter 4, Kansas City, Missouri, 1976 to 1979. One day, while sitting around the station shooting the breeze, I brought up the subject of skydiving. I mentioned that my dad had been a paratrooper in the 82nd Airborne Division in World War II. I said that my brother-in-law, Jan, was an avid skydiver and hang glider. Parachuting sounded like a lot of fun. One of the guys sitting at the table, Terry, started getting excited about the whole prospect. "There's a skydiving school in Kansas. For $30, we can get one lesson and one jump." We started making plans. Chuck, the captain, overheard us and said, "Tidyman, don't do it. You're going to get hurt." Terry argued with Captain Chuck that the sport was really very safe. He rattled off statistics regarding the ratio of death per jumps versus crossing the street. I ignored Chuck's warning, like any other good piece of advice from someone older and wiser than I was. 3 weeks later, five of us, Bill, Tom, Terry, Phil, and I, headed out in the early morning to some little town in Kansas to the jump school. The Lucky Landing Skydiving School consisted of a single wide trailer, a couple of trainers, a parking area, a single engine plane, a pilot, and a long strip of flat ground, the runway, between a lot of cornfields. Despite the 90-degree heat, we were required to wear jumpsuits, coveralls, crash helmets, and combat boots. Since this would be our first jump, we were hooked up to a static line attached to the airplane. Seconds after we jumped out, the tension on the static line would automatically open our chute. This didn't seem to me to be much of a class on skydiving, more just an opportunity to experience what it was like to jump out of a plane with a chute that automatically opened, attempt to find the landing area on your way down, and hit the ground safely. We spent 20 minutes in the classroom and another half an hour jumping off a small platform to learn the parachute landing fall. The jump from the platform was supposed to mimic hitting the ground from the sky. The instructor told us as soon as we got into the plane, the last one in should get into the jump position. Then, at the proper altitude, the pilot would yell, "Go!" This didn't mean if you were ready, but that he would be over the target area and you should jump. When the first skydiver jumped, the next moved into position. He went on and told us that we should jump straight out as if we were going to do a belly flop. Within seconds, he assured us, our chutes would open, pulling us upright. On the way down, look above your head. We would see two guidelines with handles attached to the chute. "Hold both of these," he told us, "one in each hand. If we pull the one on the left, our chutes would tilt and turn left. Likewise with the right." The reason we should do this, he explains, was that we could locate and aim for the landing area as opposed to a 1,000-acre cornfield. Once we were 50 feet from the ground, over the target area, we needed to look out at the horizon, maneuver to face the wind, and keep our feet and knees slightly apart. He advised us to keep our knees slightly bent and to roll when we hit the ground, just like we did in practice. This was 1978. These were old Army parachutes, not the current rectangular gliding chutes, so we knew we were going to hit the ground hard. The pilot could take three of us up at a time. Bill, Tom, and Terry went first. The plane took off. 10 minutes later, the plane was landing. About the same time, these three floated safely down to Earth. I jumped into the next plane, with Phil following me. He would go out first. The pilot told Phil to position himself in the doorway, one leg dangling, the other on the wing strut. Within a minute, he yelled, "Go," and Phil disappeared. I moved into position, looked down, and all of a sudden, didn't think this was such a good idea after all. I didn't sit there long enough to consider all the ramifications of the disaster, but my stomach was working on it. I recall the pilot shouting, "Go," but don't remember taking that graceful belly flop leap into the void. I remember a solid pressure giving me a hard shove in the small of my back, forcing me out of the plane. Once in the air, I felt like I was plummeting face down, and because I did not do the belly flop as instructed, I was convinced I was about to die. Again, I didn't have much time to think about this, because just then, my static line opened the chute and yanked me upright. I was going to live. I grabbed the guidelines, looked down, and discovered, oddly enough, that out in the middle of endless Kansas cornfields, everything looked the same. There were quite a few trailers, small parking areas, and long strips of land. Of course, it was a farming community. Nothing on the ground cried out, "Lucky Landing Skydiving School." I started to get a little concerned, so I just hung on to the left guideline and kept turning in circles, hoping I would recognize something. Kind of like my life. Just when I was ready to give up, I spotted the plane landing. I headed toward it, very successfully, I must say. In fact, I was so worried that I was going to land on top of it, I forgot all the landing instructions. When I hit the ground, instead of doing a slight deep knee bend and rolling, I did a severe deep knee bend. My knees shot past my ears. In fact, if my knees had bent together, I would have been a prime candidate for facial reconstruction. My legs sprang back and I rolled over. By this time, the rest of my daredevil friends had run over to ask if I was all right. I looked up and said, "Of course." I tried to stand up, and then I fell down. The instructor came over. He did not ask if I was okay. He was pissed. He was afraid my injury, however slight, would blemish the school's safety record. My friends were helpful, but they weren't exactly sympathetic. They helped me out of the jumpsuit, boots, and helmet, piled me into the car, and headed straight to the nearest convenience store for beer. I told them I was really worried and that I had screwed up my knees and wanted to go to the hospital. In between beers and laughing at me, they said that this was the dumbest thing they had ever heard. By the time we got back into Kansas City, they had a plan for me. We were also half in the bag, so it was easy for me to agree to almost anything. At 5 the following morning, Tom would come by to my apartment, help me into the car, and drive me to the station. Then he would help me into the day room and drop my ass off on one of the couches. Shift change was at 7. When my captain came in, I would start lying by informing him that I had an accident. I told him that I had come in a little early and had gone upstairs to get some orange juice. After I drank it, I decided to slide down the pole hole instead of taking the stairs. I let go of the pole too soon and wrenched my knee when I hit. Chuck looked at me and said, "God damn it, Tidyman, you hurt yourself jumping out of the plane, didn't you?" I said, "Chuck, I wrenched my knee coming down the pole hole. That's my story and I'm sticking to it." Chuck had to call the battalion chief and report the injury. The crew stuffed me into the cab of the hook and ladder and dropped me off at the hospital. Tests confirmed that I had torn the cartilage in my left knee. Actually, I had torn the cartilage in the right knee as well, but that didn't give me a problem until later on. I was admitted and successfully operated on the next day. After that, I was on sick leave for 2 months, or until my knee healed completely. 2 weeks after the operation, I could walk without crutches with only a slight limp. Since I still had almost 2 months or more to recuperate, I snagged a full-time job through a firefighter friend, fabricating for Mica countertops. It turned out to be great exercise for my leg and a wonderful addition to my income. One of the benefits, as I mentioned earlier, of the 24 to 48-hour firefighting shift was that we could work a second job or own a small business. Dale had his asphalt business. Captain Chuck had a gutter installation business. I wasn't any exception. After recuperating from my first knee injury and quitting the Formica countertop job, I started looking for a second job. Firefighters who own small businesses love hiring fellow firefighters, so it was only a matter of weeks before I found something. Battalion chief and his wife, who owned a septic tank cleaning business, were looking for a new driver. I figured, great. I would drive the septic truck, someone else would clean the tanks. How tough could that be? After introductions, a few questions, and an explanation of duties, I was hired. I quickly learned that I was the sole operator of the truck. Hence, I was also the septic tank cleaner. As usual, I didn't ask the right questions. Fortunately, the sewage pumped from septic tanks does not smell like human feces. It did, however, smell like some pretty nasty sewage. Number one, how bad could it be? Number two, I wasn't going to tell anyone what my new job was. Training was simple. Find the septic tank, find the lid, pop the lid, drop in the hose, suck out the shit, put the hose away, put the lid back on the tank, and head off to the next tank. The truck was easy to manage. It was a mid-size 4-speed and carried a 300-gallon shit storage tank. When the tank was full, I headed over to the main shit pumping station and emptied my load, so to speak. The side of the tank was emblazoned with the company name Rose Septic, along with a lovely painted rose. The owners were Bill and his wife, Rose. After working there for a few weeks, I asked Rose if the company had been named after her. Of course, as soon as the question hit the floor, I knew it was a mistake. As the veins started popping out of her forehead and neck, she screamed at me, "Do you think I'd name a shit-sucking company after me?" I instantly backpedaled and said, "No, of course not. It's just that your name is Rose and the name on the truck is, you know." After she calmed down a bit, she explained that the former owner's name was Mike Rose, and he didn't have any problem at all naming a shit-sucking company after himself. So you see, I wasn't really wrong to ask. I just asked the wrong person. I wish I could write that this job was full of hilarious and grossly embarrassing situations. It wasn't. I worked for Bill and Rose for a year. It was not easy money. In the end, I quit. At some point, I must have gotten tired of taking all that shit from people. Part of the training program at the station house involved learning how to drive the rear end of a hook and ladder truck, commonly known as the tiller. I'm sure, with a lot of practice, it can become second nature. When you first start out, though, it's a little tricky. The tiller driver steers around tight corners by swinging the back end of the truck around tight turns. To make the back end swing out and steer around these tight corners, he has to turn the steering wheel in the opposite direction of the turn. Piece of cake. The first four or five times I practiced, we were in a large, unpopulated city park. The next three or four times, we were on city streets, tooling around at a reasonable pace. By that time, I felt pretty confident that I could handle the job. Unfortunately, my captain thought so too. One day, Captain Chuck called in sick. The resulting shift in responsibilities put the driver as captain, and the tiller driver moved up to the front-end driver. I moved into the tiller seat, and a firefighter from the pump truck filled in for me. As luck would have it, an alarm came in. We all jumped into our firefighting gear and onto the truck. The substitute driver's nickname was Sudden, so named for driving any fire department vehicle out of the station very suddenly, regardless of whether or not an alarm sounded. That day was no exception. Keep in mind that in this tiller position, I was much more accustomed to leisurely drives around the city and cruising in the park. Before we got completely out of the station, I oversteered, sideswiped, and nearly took off the bay door frame with my left fender. As we made a left turn down a small street, I overcompensated again and flattened a no parking sign on the right curb with my right rear wheels. The guys in front of the truck had no idea what was going on 50 feet behind where I was sitting at the back of the truck. 20 yards down the street, we turned right. Much to my delight, I successfully negotiated that turn. We had to swerve into the opposite lane to get through traffic. This time, when I overcompensated, I hit a parked car. My thinking at the moment was that it was just a parked car. Better to proceed to the fire and save lives and property. The alarm turned out to be false. Before we got back on the truck, I walked up to Parker, the acting captain, and told him that I had hit a car on the way to the alarm. I didn't mention the bay door or the no parking sign. Parker said, "You did what?" I explained what happened. He said, "Why didn't you hit the foot buzzer on the floor? We would have stopped and left you there. We could have put someone in your seat." I asked, "What buzzer? Besides, aren't we supposed to get to the alarm first, especially if no one was involved in the crash?" Parker slowly explained to me what the foot buzzer was all about and what the standard procedure was, and then walked off to call the battalion chief to report the situation. In the meantime, the owner of the vehicle I hit, who happened to be sitting in it at the time, had crawled across the seat to the passenger door to get out, dusted the broken bits of glass off his lap, and probably turned in time to see the tail end of the truck speeding down the street. It turned out that I had caved in the entire left side of his brand new late model Buick LeSabre taxicab. The fire truck had fared better, with just a little scratch on the fender. The cab driver, who was not injured at all, had been parked less than a half a block from the fire station, so he walked over to it to look for some answers. Within 30 minutes, we were all back at the scene of the accident. I explained to the battalion chief my theory on the seriousness of accidents involving civilians versus the seriousness of firefighting. He spent a couple of minutes re-educating me. After the chief and the taxi driver exchanged information, the taxi driver walked up to me. By now, he knew that I was at least somewhat responsible for destroying his cab. I must have looked the part, because when he came up to me, he put his hand on my shoulder and said, "Hey, little brother, why, just last week I was driving me a semi-tractor trailer in New York City, and I drug a car for 2 blocks before I knew it." I thought that was pretty funny. It made me feel better. The feeling didn't last for long. The next day, Captain Chuck was back. We had a little meeting. Although he professed that he loved me like a son, he felt that recent episodes, such as injuring myself when I fell down the pole hole and wrecking the cab, kind of put in question my judgment and, in turn, the safety of the crew. He suggested that I might be better off in a less active station. I couldn't disagree with him because it would not have done me any good. He may also have been right. I transferred to a new station within a week. My new station was a sleepy little place on the outskirts of one of the state parks in Kansas City. Unless the forest burst into flame, which didn't happen on my watch, there wasn't much firefighting to do. The station housed one pump truck and also served as the garage for the chief of the fire department's company car. The only fire I recall going to was a log cabin fire. It was a storage cabin for park administration files. You could not have put together a structure more suited to a great conflagration.